Welcome to the Senate Committee on Education and Workforce Development. First, I want to say hello to the honorary pages from the Senate. They're in our committee today, including an exchange student from Norway.
That's right.
So, welcome to all of you.
They have a personal relationship with one of our members, too, by the way.
Yes. On our agenda today, we are going to take a look at what the House has been working on, House Bill 3120, the overall governance meeting and governance bill, and how it couples with the bill that we've been working on for the last 3 months. Before we get to that, let's get this one bill out of the way and pass this on. Let me do a work session on House Bill 3296A. There's no issues here that came up. If you want to give us a quick reminder summary.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3296A modifies, for the purposes of relating student athlete agents, the definition of athlete agent and agency contract. It expands those definitions and it requires athlete agent to notify the educational institution in writing before initiating any contact with a student athlete.
Okay. We had some questions come up in the hearing last week. Those questions have been resolved. No other issues, and unless you raise them here, I'm ready to pass it out.
Let's go.
Okay. Senator Thoreau,
you're... Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3296A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Knope moves House Bill 3296A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none, is there objection? Seeing none, the motion passes to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Senator Courtney will be the carrier. Okay, I would like to open up an informational meeting on House Bill 3120. The Governor's Office of Ben Cannon and House Committee Chair Mike Denbrough is here to walk us through what they did on their side. If you gentlemen could join us. I think we might want to start with your presentation, Dan.
Thank you, Chair, House members of the committee. For the record, Ben Cannon, Governor's Education Policy Advisor. I assume when you spoke to their side, you meant Representative Denbrough's side.
Yes.
Join all of you on behalf of the governor in this work.
We're letting him go.
Yeah. So I do have a presentation here that I'll bring up or ask the staff to. I thought that in my few minutes with you today, I'd try to do a couple of things, mostly to describe where we're at organizationally with respect to higher ed, how Senate Bill 270 fits into changes to that organization, and then focusing, as you've asked, on how a companion bill, House Bill 3120, that Representative Denbrough spearheaded in the House, would fit in with this evolving governance structure for higher education in Oregon. Just a sort of caveat, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on why the governor is supportive of this work, except to say here at the outset that we are, the governor is excited about the possibility of providing greater autonomy for our institutions of higher education alongside greater coordination at the state level. The upshot of our work this session for the governor cannot be further fragmentation of the higher education system, and it's why he looks at 270 and House Bill 3120 as really two sides of the same coin, taking a jumble of boards and commissions and agencies, further streamlining, consolidating, and clarifying responsibility for who's responsible for achieving higher education outcomes on the part of the state. So I'll just sort of leave it at that in terms of rationale and his support for 270 and 3120. So I'm going to start by actually going back to before 2011, and this is how we understood our the organization of our higher education system. By higher education, I'm including our universities, our state need-based financial aid program, the Oregon Opportunity Grant in particular, and our community colleges. And I'll spend just a moment sort of helping you acquaint yourself with the chart and what's described here. The blue bars or the blue boxes are boards or councils. You'll note that the 17 community colleges on the right hand each have independent institutional governing boards, and the State Board of Education, I'm over on the right-hand side, has authorities that are expressed through these dashed lines. Those authorities have to do with allocating state of funding that the legislature has appropriated to the Board of Ed, program approval, so when community colleges apply for new programs, they go to the State Board of Ed for that approval, adopting state rules that affect community colleges. So that authority is expressed through these dashed lines. On the left-hand side, of course, the State Board of Higher Ed shares that authority, those state funding allocation, program approval, state rules, et cetera. Likewise, on this slide, you'll see a solid line from the State Board of Higher Ed. It is also the governing authority for our seven universities. It, for example, hires or fires the executives of those institutions. So this is the pre-2011 slide. The main shift that we related to this, I mean, there were a bunch of, frankly, even more important things that happened in 2011, principally under Senate Bill 242. But one of the features of Senate Bill 242 that the legislature passed in 2011 was to establish a coordinating council, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, which was established to really provide advice and coordination for the entire higher education system. So you'll see on this slide no dashed or solid lines coming from, no solid blue line coming from the HEC. It doesn't have today governing authority, nor does it have the funding allocation authority, program approval authority, rulemaking authority to affect the higher education system directly. But it does. It is responsible for, in current law, for kind of coordinating this higher education system. So that's the state of things in current law. I'm going to move to Senate Bill 270 here, and of course you're familiar with this, having moved it out of your committee, so I don't need to spend too long with it. But the changes that it affects are profound, and you understand that. The State Board of Higher Ed is reconstructed essentially as an institutional board with parallel powers to those institutional boards established at U of O, PSU, and possibly OSU. And all four of those boards are responsive and responsible to the Higher Education Coordinating Commission for funding allocation by formula, presumably, for program approval, the coordination of the system through state coordination of the university system through rule would be done by the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. So this is obviously you take one legal entity today and you turn it into three or four legal entities under Senate Bill 270. And it's obviously a very significant change to how our university system would be constructed. You'll note that the Higher Education Coordinating Commission under Senate Bill 270 retains its advisory responsibilities for the entirety of the higher education system, including financial aid and community colleges, but its direct sort of authorities related to funding, program approval, state rules, et cetera, are expressed only for or are in place under 270 only for the university system. And there is some imbalance in that from our standpoint, that you'd have a coordinating commission that has this really direct authority on the university side, but really just advisory responsibilities for other parts of the higher education system. And this is where this is, in a sense, where 3120 picks up. The special committee that worked on this topic during the interim addressed really the recommendations, creative recommendations that became the basis for 270, did not get to the kind of broader question of what how that would fit into the rest of the higher education system. So 3120 would do a few things, and I'll stick with the chart here and then add to it. The first is that it would provide for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission the same authorities related to funding distribution and program approval for community colleges that it has under 270 for the university system. It would basically get the State Board of Education out of the business of overseeing community colleges. And it would replace that board with the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. It would also replace the Oregon Student Access Commission as the citizen sort of policy setting board for oversight of the state's financial aid programs for students. So under 3120, if it were to become law, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission would become the single state board responsible for higher education in Oregon in conjunction, and I can imagine your questions about the OEIB, and I'll get to that in the end, but in conjunction with the OEIB and working with these institutional boards that exist for each of our community colleges and universities.
But can I question
that? Yes.
That's oversee, but not necessarily governance. So if Western Oregon needs a new water treatment plant, that's not in the Hex-Bailey group.
Mr. Chair, members of the committees, that is correct. And so you'll note that the HEC, emanating from the HEC, are these dashed lines and not the solid governance line. The HEC would not be a governing board, at least in the way that I'm using governance to represent decision-making authorities at the kind of institutional level related to governance of the institution, frankly, and campus-level decisions. So this is obviously these slides simplify what's a pretty complex pieces of legislation, both 270 and 3120, that divide authorities between institutional boards and the state. But generally speaking, that's right. The HEC would not be in the business of governing our institutions, and this is really consistent with this philosophy of tight and loose that we've talked about, the governor's talked about, where the state is providing greater autonomy to institutions to govern and run themselves as they see fit, consistent with the state's responsibility for outcomes for students and our investment responsibility to steer those investments in ways that help produce those outcomes.
Well, if I could further then clarify then, so then the boards who have their own institutional boards would figure out how to do their own water treatment plant or parking lots or whatever they do, but the universities who don't have their own boards, then if they need a water treatment plant, they're still governed just the way they used to be under the State Board of Higher Education?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the way I read 270, yes, essentially the State Board of Higher Education becomes the institutional board, if you will, for the four or five universities that don't have their own. Now, obviously, you've created a process during the interim to attempt to understand whether this is the final landing spot for the smaller universities and possibly OSU, or whether there will be some other configuration of institutional boards for them. I'm going to just add to the organizational chart, say a few more words about 3120 before taking questions and giving Representative Dimbro the floor here. When the governor described this notion for the university system or for the higher education system, really a single place of coordination and focus for the state, he also described in his budget a single agency to support that commission, and we called it, for lack of better words, we called it the Department of Post-Secondary Education. In response to stakeholder and legislative feedback, we have sort of backed away from that notion. The Higher Education Coordinating Commission clearly would have significant responsibilities to fulfill that would require some staff to help it fulfill it, particularly with respect to the university system. So what we've proposed, though, is to leave in place the Oregon Student Access Commission as an agency, Office of Student Access, perhaps. It has a different name in 3120, but basically it would continue to be the agency that the HEC would operate through for the purpose of administering or overseeing financial aid. Likewise, CCWD for the purpose of support for community colleges. We envision, when we look at 270 and the HEC's responsibilities in 270 and as well as 3120, we do envision some small staff necessary for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to deploy or fulfill its responsibilities. And then you'll see here also the shared services to support at least the universities and potentially someday other institutions as well. So these light blue bars representing where agency staff, I use that word agency loosely because we wouldn't put shared services in a state agency, but the sort of staff to support this work would exist. Before turning it over to Representative Denbrough or for questions, I just want to note, and with real appreciation to him for his leadership in helping put the 3120 work group together, just note the participation, the really broadly participatory process that that he led on the House side that included representatives from OUS, the State Board of Higher Ed, CCWD, OSAC, the Oregon Students Association, the Oregon Community College Association, AOI, the Oregon Community Foundation, AFT Oregon, PSU Eastern, Oregon Business Council. We had legislative directors for the Speaker and Senate President participating, involved, and so really broadly inclusive, and I think a real great deal of support. And it's unfortunately the way this process works, and you know, with policy bills that go to Ways and Means, that both policy committees don't get the ability to sort of directly weigh in on, or at least they do weigh in, I suppose, but not sort of own the process. Because I think you would have appreciated the inclusiveness of it and the level of support that the bill that his committee sent to Ways and Means received from the stakeholders that I have mentioned. I guess that is where I will stop on this and see if there are questions.
Senator Beyer, you have a question for Ben?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ben, there's one more slide in your packet, at least in the one we've got. It has the OEIB as part of the chart. Are you going to address that? That's the one.
Yeah, I forgot about that one. Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer. Yeah, because I know the question, I anticipated a question about the OEIB's relationship to this. This final slide here actually reflects on the left-hand side the pre-K through 12 work. Some of this is actually still in bill form, also in Ways and Means, where we've really tried to consolidate the agency support for our pre-K-12 work in the Oregon Department of Education. And you'll see a little bit of DHS here still on the agency side. And we've tried to streamline the board and commission structure. So, you know, we're down to, I guess, five here, including OEIB, the Early Learning Council, the YDC, the State Board of Ed, and the HEC. It is, you know, for some, this would represent a point on the journey that is not yet to complete towards greater levels of consolidation, both at the agency and board level. We're interested in thinking with you about what those next steps might be. The OEIB's role here, obviously, is to be responsible for the entire P20 system and provide some advice and direction to the other boards and commissions. But we're also pretty focused on the Oregon Education Investments Board's responsibility in guiding investments, not being the state board that establishes all the rules and regulations for education in Oregon. That the governor believes would be a mistake to encumber the Oregon Education Investment Board with rulemaking for the universities and for community colleges and for funding formulas for OSAC and community colleges and universities and, you know, the charter school appeals associated with K-12 and school bus safety rules and all the host of regulations that come up through the State Board of Ed. So the OEIB, it would be strategically focused on achievement compacts, on investment advice to the governor and legislature, really focused on strategic investments to meet the state goals. And then finally, the connection points that no other board here is responsible for, principally between high school and college.
So the as we talked about this in 11, 12, whatever it was, from the OEIB, the notion is that looking ahead to the future, the control and accountability point for the legislature is going to be through the OEIB, and the contact from them on down to the delivery institutions would be the education compacts. So I'm trying to get a linkage on that, and the recommendations on funding would come from the OEIB as well for the various things.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I would say, you know, that the question of whether the OEIB becomes the sole sort of focal point for the state's kind of connection with the delivery system, as we've called it, is, I think, an open one. The OEIB should not, as I've said before, in our view, should not be encumbered by all the kind of rulemaking and oversight responsibilities that some of these other boards and commissions today have. So while, yes, the OEIB would hold the compact and would have a significant role in defining kind of a strategic plan for the state's investments and policies related to education, P20, we've not gone so far this session as to say that all of the authorities today held by Early Learning Council for child care and early learning programs, the YDC, the Youth Development Commission, the State Board of Ed for K-12, and the HEC, or State Board of Higher Ed, State Board of Ed for Community Colleges and NOSAC, we've not gone so far as to say that that all goes to OEIB, in part because it would make, from my way, and I think the governor's way of seeing it, would make it pretty hard to manage the OEIB.
I guess I have a concern that you're, rather than increasing accountability, you're diffusing it and making it more murky across the board by doing that, and make it harder for the legislature to really hold, I guess, the executive department accountable and have clear lines of authority. I'm really concerned about that. I thought the better direction was to put it into a single line of command, so we had a clear chain of command there.
Senator Beyer, Mr.
Chair. Your tight, loose framework.
And Senator Beyer, Mr. Chair, I think I alluded to the fact this may be for some a sort of stopping point on a journey towards even greater levels of consolidation of authorities and clarity of accountability. We're very much open to those conversations. To be clear, this is a much more, what you're looking at here is a much simpler and more consolidated system of agencies and boards than exists today. It's unfortunate I can't show you this slide under current law. Part of the reason I can't show you it is because it's really hard to draw. It's really complicated. So the work that's involved in this legislative session to get to what you're seeing here is significant, and it may be only a portion of what needs to be done, but it is a significant piece of work nonetheless.
Mr. Chair, if I can jump in at this point. Michael Dembrough, for the record, Representative, House District 45. So, you know, if we look back to 2011, actually 2010, when the work was first beginning that led to Senate Bill 242, we were working in consultation with some national experts, WICHE, NCHEMS, you know, those experts on higher education and governance. And the HEC was actually created before the OEIB, you might recall. It was first developed actually before the governor was elected. And part of our struggle over the next couple of years was, okay, how do we get these systems to align? But, you know, one of the things that Dennis Jones from NCHEMS and Dave Longenecker from WICHE advised us to do is to really pay attention to the HEC. That the role of the HEC was going to be even more important if we had a pre-K-20 board. That they were themselves, looking at it from the perspective of higher ed, they were not sympathetic to K-12, to K-20 boards. They felt that whenever you have, if you look at the states where there's a pre-K-20 board, higher ed ends up being lost in the shuffle, that, you know, all the attention is placed on K-12, and you know, in fact, that is kind of how it's played out. So what they advised us to do was to make the HEC as strong as possible, to be a strong advocate for the issues related to higher ed. We were not able to do that, certainly in a funding sense, into 2012. In fact, we never filled the office of executive officer for the HEC, which was in statute. And you know, part of what's happening here in the work in 3120 is that the HEC is finally assuming its, you know, really its rightful place. And, you know, to be the, you know, to be able to advise the OEIB on matters related to performance compacts, achievement compacts, and funding, but in other respects, be really the strategic locus for all of post-secondary. And, you know, I think the vision that's being laid out here and that, you know, those of us who, you know, who worked on the work group and, you know, did some visioning of, so what are some of the, you know, the potential benefits of having a single board that would be coordinating all of post-secondary? It would really put Oregon in a place for some conversations that we've been unable to have over the years. And I'll give you an example of that. I was at a town hall a couple of weeks ago, and the focus of the town hall was higher ed affordability. And there was a young woman, I think she was a college student, was responding to the fact that the Oregon Opportunity Grant is so severely underfunded, and not only underfunded, but it's unstable. You know, a student might get one year, and then the next year they don't get one. The following year they might, but on the other hand, they might have dropped out in the meantime. And so the student asked, well, why can't we set up the Opportunity Grant program so that it's for 2 years? You know, you would get it for 2 years or get it for 4 years. As long as you remained successful in your program, you could count on that. And, you know, that was really interesting because that was also a recommendation that came out of a task force that we had a couple of years ago, the Task Force on Student Success, and, you know, was to you know, look at perhaps reshaping the opportunity grant so there's more of a focus on completion and ability for students to complete. And after that, the recommendation came out of that task force. Well, its recommendations went to three different boards, the State Board of Education for CCs, the State Board of Higher Ed for universities, and the OSAC board for, you know, the actual opportunity grant program. And not much, if anything, has happened, you know, since then. Under this new scenario, there's, you know, the HEC, which is now overseeing all of the, overseeing, you know, is probably not the right word, but is coordinating all of post-secondary, including the independent colleges, which, you know, whose students also are eligible for the opportunity grant. This kind of conversation can happen really in the right venue, and some decisions can come out of it, as opposed to, you know, one board making its stance and then going into negotiations with another board, et cetera, et cetera. You know, I think that I don't know if you've had a chance to look at the Secretary of State's audit on higher ed. Came out a couple of weeks ago from OUS. And one of the real concerns that they have is with our fragmented higher education governance system, and one of their recommendations, key recommendations, is to try to bring them into greater alignment. And that's what we're doing here. I think that we are achieving through 3120 that it's helping us to hit that sweet spot that we talked about as we're giving you know, greater autonomy to individual universities. How do we still hold the system together so that students are able to move pretty effortlessly from institution to institution, from community college to university, university to university, you know, it's from K-12 to post-secondary, et cetera. And, you know, I think this really is a step in the right direction. Just in terms of timelines, you know, I'll say that you know, what 3120 envisions, just as Senate Bill 270 envisions, is that over the next year, further work is going to be done on this governance area, you know, with respect to what we do with the regional and technical universities. Are they best off having their own boards? Are they best off having a coordinated board? What will what will be most beneficial to them and their students. That conversation will happen. There'll be another conversation around shared services. What's the best way to do shared services among the seven universities? And perhaps, and this conversation is going on as well, perhaps extending shared services in a voluntary way to community colleges, to the independent universities. Is there a path there to help further take advantage of economies of scale, et cetera? So that's all going to happen in advance of the February session. At the same time, we're going to be working on, bringing the CCWD, OSAC, the universities into closer alignment in terms of the workflow of their different offices. And, we think finding some efficiencies there. And if not always efficiencies, I think in a lot of respects, these are going to become much more effective agencies through the closer alignment of the offices.
Before we take questions, Representative Johnson, you were a major participant in this. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for your work. And I'd like to get your overview of this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, Mark Johnson, State Rep for House District 52. I think to a large extent we're here today in some ways because of what happened in the previous session with the passage of Senate Bill 242, which created some benefits for our higher ed system. It also created the heck. And to a certain extent, we've been chasing our tail since that time, trying to figure out what do we do now. We have a preponderance of governance boards and committees and so forth, and I think most people recognize it's just not a long-term workable solution. There's a definite need for consolidation. And to some degree, I think, we felt like some of those in our government were counseled prior to the invasion of Iraq. If you break it, you're going to have to put it back together again. And I think what you find in this bill is an attempt to begin that process to put it back together again in a way that works. I've been a proponent all along for consolidation, I think, and Representative Dembro and I had a bill on our committee in 2012 that led to the creation of the special committee that met during the interim to investigate the institutional board piece, but we also knew that consolidation was going to need to come as well, and that's what I think you see here in House Bill 312020 as an attempt to bring that to pass. You've heard from Representative Dembro, I'm sure, an exhaustive report on our work. I voted against this bill coming out of committee along with my colleagues, and not because I don't agree with the concepts laid out here. My concerns were primarily twofold. I don't think we've had enough time to really fully vet the concept yet. There are a lot of, Ben's done a wonderful job with his PowerPoint. I don't know if you've given them with the one with all the arrows going this way and that and all of that and so forth. So those are good things. What I still can't quantify, and I hope that by the time we are finished with our work in this session that we all can answer the question of, are we leaner now? I can't fully answer that question yet. I don't know. Are we simply transferring responsibilities from CCWD, for instance, into the HEC and so forth? At the end of the day, we end up with just as many people, but perhaps they have different titles. I don't know the answer to that. I'd like to have more clarity on that. Secondly, I'm concerned with the makeup of the HEC. I'm concerned that we're potentially creating a board of stakeholders rather than a strategic board that can make decisions about what's best for education in Oregon. Michael, and I see that differently, and I respect that, but if, in fact, we're giving more power, more responsibility, more authority to the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission, to me, it seems incumbent upon us to ensure that we're setting them up to be successful. And each member on that board needs to be in a position of making the decisions that they believe in are right for higher ed in Oregon rather than are right for the members that they're there to represent. So those are my concerns, and I think there's an opportunity still while we're here in this building before signing day to get some answers to those questions and to provide some clarity. But that's where I am today, and I'm confident that we can work together in a bipartisan, bicameral fashion to get to a yes.
Yep.
Senator Byer,
you had a question?
I do. Thank you. I share some of your concerns, Representative Johnson. I guess the question I have is, when I'm looking at the purple boxes there, and I assume there's a chief staff person for each of those, you talk to me about the reporting structure of staff. Maybe that'll add to my comfort.
Senator Beyer, Senator Haas, I have another slide for you, sir. The very final slide here attempts to map the kind of chief officers related to each of the boards and commissions, as well as how they're appointed and confirmed in the case of several of these folks. This is, again, a P20 slide, so we're focused primarily on the right-hand side of it, higher ed today. But our assumption is that, in fact, the existing law calls for an executive officer for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, and our assumption is that that executive officer would sort of direct the staff at community CCWD and OSAC and probably have some university-related staff in order to fulfill their responsibilities under 270 relative to the university system, and that, you know, is being costed out as this bill and as 270 and 3120 move to Ways and Means. I think the questions that Representative Johnson raises about whether this sort of leans the organization or not are really important ones, and ones that we're attempting to get answered in the fiscal context down in Ways and Means. And clearly the bills won't move until we have pretty clear answers to those questions and understand where the dollars will be applied. I will say that if this legislation was just to pass 270, set 3120 aside for the moment, just to pass 270, the authorities envisioned by 270 for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission are important, they're significant, and they will require some staff to fulfill. This commission cannot effectively deal with the missions of the universities, the programs of the universities, and the funding of the allocations to the universities, and those aren't its only responsibilities. Prepare a budget request for the universities and so on and so forth. It cannot do that without a staff. So today it has no staff. So we're working on that in the context of 270 and 3120.
At a minimum, we needed to give some muscle to the tech board if we're creating these university boards. Absolutely. That must answer to the
correct.
Right. And let me say very, very quickly that legislative fiscal was part of the work group, and they're already thinking about how do we put these two bills together. I mean, obviously, you know, 270, 3120, they're going to be, you know, inextricably interlocked. And so how do they make that work? They're already starting that work. I do want to say in response to Rep. Johnson's points about who serves on the HEC, that the HEC, you know, under this legislation, we are extending the way that the current HEC is made up, as well as the way the State Board of Higher Ed is made up. You may or may not know that the State Board of Higher Ed has two faculty, two students on it currently, as does the HEC. Nobody has seen any problems with that makeup. In fact, Matt Donegan, who's the current president of the State Board of Higher Ed, came to the special joint committee and testified that this was surprisingly to him, actually surprisingly effective, to have students and faculty on the State Board of Higher Ed. So it seemed to make the most sense, you know, because nobody had anything to point to where this was a problem. Rather than to be speculative about it, let's just continue the status quo.
Is that approved?
Yeah, Ben, could you go back one slide? It appears to me that OAIB is destined to become a state agency based on your colors.
Senator Haas, Senator Cruz, so the OAIB has sort of, take a step back.
I'm just looking at your colors.
Yeah, okay. And so we asked Legislative Council, actually, to, before this session began, to draft a bill that would permit the OAIB's staff, and today there are a handful of staff people, to exist somewhere other than the governor's office, which is where they're parked today. And Legislative Council said, well, you don't need a bill. The authority that they have under 909 to hire a chief education officer, who in turn has the authority to hire staff, means that if the legislature budgets for them as an agency, they're an agency. The blue bar, the light blue bar under OEIB, does signify the fact that the OEIB has that authority, that we've proposed a budget for the OEIB that continues to fund a chief education officer and a small staff to help steer this overall P20 system, including proposing and leading strategic investments for the state relative to education.
Well, I would suggest, if I could, Ms. Chair, that once a board becomes an agency, it takes on a life of its own, and I would look at DLCD as a prime example, because it started out as a commission, and now it is the God Squad for land use. And you're saying that OEIB isn't going to be doing all of these things, but I would suggest over time that is how it will evolve, because that is our history in the state of Oregon.
I will remind you, Senator Cruz, that OEIB sunsets in 2016, and it's going to have to prove itself over the next couple of years, I think, for that sunset to be removed. If you look at 3120, you see that we had to write it in different ways. There are different sections that apply to whether or not the OEIB is in place, and also looking beyond that, where it might not be in place. We have to do what's going to be most effective for Oregon students, whether we have an OEIB or not.
Okay, and if I just follow up, I'm not necessarily saying, I mean, the way your graph is there, we've got two darn many agencies, okay? And I'm not saying that having the agency structure that is more inclusive is not necessarily a bad idea. My issue would be, is OEIB the right structure? So.
Senator Hess, Senator Cruz, it's fair to say the governor shares your concern about too many agencies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Senator Barr.
Two questions, Mr. Chair. One, I assume, what the heck, we would continue the current operation of the provost councils, which advise on curriculum, all that. So that's a given. That's not a staffing. That's just sort of a commitment to the university.
Yeah, we were thinking about calling that out, Senator Beyer, Chair Haas, in the bill. We decided just to put as one of the HECS authorities that they can that they will be advised by technical committees. Our thought was the provost council, the interfaculty, interinstitutional faculty senate, you know, those bodies that are now making sure that we have a coherent university academic program.
Yeah, I mean, the provost council, they tend to, in reality, work most of that out before they come to form. So I think that's a positive. The other question, Ben, I'm just curious to Senator Cruz's question, why not just reconfigure the Department of Education as the staffing function? I'm not talking about the councils, but just use that as your administrative agency for the whole thing.
Senator Haas, Senator Beyer, I think it's a very good question. We considered that in the development of our budget and policy recommendations for 2013. The governor concluded that would be a bridge too far for this session. Given the reaction that we got when we proposed the consolidation of a single higher education department, collapsing OSAC and CCWD and the university level support that the HEC will provide, and the blowback we got there, I think it justified the caution that we felt before we move forward with anything like a single agency for education in Oregon.
Well, my fear is in your restructuring as you're doing this. There's a tendency to solve all the political problems to just add to, and I think there's enough staffing that if you rearrange how you do that, there's no reason to have separate bookkeeping, accounting departments, and a lot of that work seems like it can be centralized. And I would encourage you to at least consider that. And I mean, I would feel, I liked your staffing structure, the way it comes up. I would feel most comfortable if the head of the education department was the chief education officer. With it functionalized under that, I mean, I think that makes sense to do that.
So,
just a comment.
Thank you.
Well, I know how, more than most, I know how thorny this question is. And I have seen dozens of these variation of these charts, and in fact the task force that got together to recommend university boards was also tasked to figure this out, and it couldn't, and it didn't. So this all got dropped on your committee, Representative Dembro, to try and do this, and it's just a really thorny issue. It's thornier than the university boards, frankly. The issue that we worked on, it had its own landmines and issues, but the problem with this is you're just never going to make anybody happy, and it's not as simple as simply consolidating these things. So I do agree, at least with the concept of taking one step now, knowing that this is a continued work in progress, and knowing that as these university boards and 242 starts to take hold, that some of the answers will become obvious over the next 6 months or so. So
right. And I will add that, you know, as Ben mentioned, it has generated a high level of support from people who are, you know, who you would expect to be really terrified of a change in the status quo. And so I think we are moving in the right direction there. I do want to thank the governor's office for spending so much time helping us with this, and Oregon Business Council for giving us Hans Bernard, who did a lot of the legwork, a lot of the day-to-day.
That explains the problem if Hans is involved.
Thank you.
Senator Hess, if I may say one more thing about 3120 that's not expressed in any of the organizational charts, but you go back to 270 and the level of authority that it describes for the HEC, 3120 takes the step of basically permitting the governor to reconstitute the HEC, to reappoint the membership of the HEC consistent with its new level of responsibility under 270 as well as 3120 if both were to pass. It also, as Michael's alluded to, recharters the HEC's overarching sort of general authority statute consistent with what's envisioned for it in 270 as well as the changes that we've described here for 3120. So you get sort of a cleaner picture of what the Higher Education Coordinating Commission is meant to do. I'll leave with your committee staff for your files just a brief sort of 1 1/4 page overview of House Bill 3120.
Okay. Thank you both very much.
Thank you all.
You can make that with labels, couldn't you?
I'm going to close the informational hearing, and I will open up a public hearing on House Bill 2299A. Could you give us a quick summary, Richard?
Sure.
Representative Reed is here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2299A directs the State Registrar for the Center for Health Statistics to send data files containing parents' names and mothers' addresses to the Oregon 529 College Savings Board for each child born in Oregon to the residents of the state. It requires the Oregon 529 College Savings Board to send notice to parents of the child in question of the opportunity to open a college savings account, and it directs the Oregon 529 College Savings Board to establish college savings account at the request of the parent. It does contain a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Tobias Reed from Beaverton, and unlike the bill that or the concept you were discussing previously, this is a quite simple and I think quite common sense approach. Your committee staff is handing out some graphs that I think are pretty stark, and the chair knows well, as we've talked about this frequently, that one of the things that predicts employment and wages is education. You can see that quite clearly on the side. These graphs come from the Office of Economic Analysis, and on the other side, some compelling evidence about the importance and power of starting to save for higher education early. So this bill simply asks the health authority to help connect the Oregon College Savings Plan, the 529 network, with new parents. Many of you are parents, and maybe you had a different experience than I did. But when we brought our daughter home from the hospital 3.5 years ago, I wasn't necessarily in the space to think about financial things. But soon after that was a good time for me to think about getting started on a 529 plan. And I have that experience again next week, so I'll start to think about what that's like again. But it's a very powerful thing to start on a savings plan at an early time. One of the key performance indicators for key performance measures for the 529 network, and the executive director is here so we can get his opinion, his input too, is the number of people who are signed up in the 529 network. That allows the costs of operation to be spread over a greater number of people, and it obviously gets people in a better spot for higher education. So we've asked the 529 network to sign people up. This is also, or could also be viewed as an efficiency measure because it connects the 529 network with people at a time when they might be particularly receptive to understanding and thinking about these issues. It's a one-time exercise that 529 Network would let these new parents know about the program, the fact that there is a tax advantage to it. They would go through an intergovernmental agreement to facilitate the exchange of that information, take that security very seriously, and then destroy that information after they've made their one contact. So I think it's among the more modest things that that we'll have a chance to do, but something that could make a difference for a number of families. I appreciate your consideration of it. Hope you'll move it forward, and happy to answer any questions.
Senator Cruz.
Thank you. What if the mother, I guess I'm wondering if you're jumping the gun a little bit here, I'm wondering if the first contact should be with the mother to find out if she wants that information transferred rather than automatically doing it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, the bill contemplates a single, and perhaps Mr. Parker is better situated to answer exactly what the content is, but my understanding is there would be a single piece of mail that says, here's what the 529 plan is. If you're interested in participating, these are the steps you would take. That's it. So it's simply an information piece.
Mr. Chair, I understand that. What I'm saying is that we are, I mean, statistics has the information, but we are putting that information in another source without the parent's permission whatsoever. See what I'm saying?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, I suppose that's true. I know that when we brought our daughter home 3.5 years ago, I got a lot of information from people who maybe didn't have my daughter's best interests at heart trying to sell me things. So I think that information is certainly accessible through a variety of other sources.
I guess maybe if
just public record.
Yeah, it is public record, but it's public record given in different places. I'm wondering if maybe we shouldn't consider that the notice that goes to the mother says, this is your option, your child's data is here, and so they might have the ability to remove that data if they didn't want to play.
That's a good idea.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, I think if they don't want to participate in the 529 network, that's certainly their option, and that's the end.
Except the data is still in that system, right?
No, Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, after that, and I'm happy to be corrected by Mr. Parker, but the current plan, as I understand it, is be transferred to the 529 network for the purpose of that single contact, and that's the end. Then it's destroyed by the 529 network and is not retained by the 529 network unless those parents elect to become a participant and then have an account.
Okay. Thanks for clearing that up.
Yeah. No problem.
Mr. Parker?
Is he nodding behind me, I hope?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Michael Parker, Executive Director of the Oregon College Savings Network. Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Okay.
Once the data is transferred to us, we have folks in our IT shop that will secure that data. We'll do the mailing. The data gets destroyed. And it's going to happen once a quarter. So we'll get data once a quarter from Vital Statistics, do the mailing, destroy the data on a go-forward basis.
Okay. That's helpful.
Do you have any data or reason to believe that when parents, especially new parents, especially those who don't even know what a 529 is, just are receptive to that?
Mr. Chair, there's been a lot of studies done about sort of funding accounts and then having those accounts grow as folks know about the accounts. We haven't done any specific studies, but there have been studies done that show that if you just have an account in your name, you're more likely to start using it. I'll give you an example just here. When we do a number of contests where people win accounts from us, we've looked at those accounts over time. Those folks do not close those accounts. They keep those accounts open and they continue to fund them. So just anecdotally speaking, when we do account giveaways in our program, those accounts stay open.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I would think if you could just get 20 seconds of a new parent's time, which is a lot, the baby, to show them this chart that you have here about the benefits of starting early instead of starting late, it's pretty remarkable. Other questions? All right. Thank you both.
Thank you.
You signed up for this? All right. Jody Weiser.
Okay.
send them this 27.
Okay. Why did you come here instead of, or did they just discover this on the back end, or what it's costing? Okay.
For the record, Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness Oregon. We're concerned about the 529 program because there's the incidence of use is almost entirely by people of the highest incomes in the state. And when you do a calculation of what does it mean if a family where, say, both of the parents worked at Intel, so they have a good family income. If they use this program every year from the year of birth through probably the child's completion of college when they're 21, we're assuming the best, of course, the state's contribution to that child's education, our grant to that child's education, is $15,286.
What are you basing that on?
If I'm basing it on the $381 that they probably save in taxes each year as they put their $4,000 plus in, and growth of the fund at 6% a year. So because what happens is it's like two IRAs at once. You don't pay taxes as you put the money in, and you don't pay taxes on the capital gains as it comes out. So that's
what you're debating is 529s in general.
In general.
This bill says to whoever, if you're unemployed or you're working as a plumber or Intel or wherever, you should know about this. And if you can start putting away $20 a month, this will help. A lot of people I know who are in the 529 program do not put in $4,000 a year. And I know a lot of Intel people who would not consider themselves wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
So you're assuming that everyone who starts off at the beginning of that child starts putting in the maximum amount every year to get to that figure.
I was using that example. It's a huge example.
This is more of an informational bill. I think we're trying. I think through this bill to do exactly what you would like to see happen with 529 to get this information into the hands of young parents who may not know about it. Because you're right, the wealthy, the folks with CPAs, and they're saying, pointing these out, saying make sure you invest as much as you can here. What I would like to do, and I think you would too, is to get this used by more middle class or lower income families. I see this as a way.
So what scares me about it is that we will increase its use and decrease the revenue that we have for the other program we have, the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program, and the average needs-based grant that we're giving is $2,000 because we're only funding 20%. So if a kid's in school for 5 years, they really have one chance of getting it. And so that this equity between $2,000 that we're giving to the needs-based kids and $15,000 that we're giving to my grandkid is just wrong. That's the scary part. And if this works, we will reduce the money in the general fund. And we will get more people saving for their kids. But it's likely to be the kids who were going to go to college anyway, because knowing about the program doesn't give you enough money to fund it. That's my concern.
Okay.
If we were in an up year, I probably wouldn't say that. But in an up year, we would probably be adding significantly to the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program, and we're not. And so it's that conflict, really.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you. Anyone else here to testify on House Bill 2299? If not, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2299. It has a referral to Ways and Means Committee. I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 2299.
Chair, I move House Bill 2299A to the floor with a due-pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Knope moves House Bill 2299 to the floor with a due-pass recommendation, and then it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there discussion? Seeing none, is there objection? Seeing none. Motion passes. We'll let Representative Reed take his fight to the Ways and Means people. Yes. Okay. We might have to do some carryover of some bills. We lost some of our witnesses due to House floor sessions and caucuses and activity. We'll carry over House Bill 2193 and House Bill 2095.
2 hours earlier.
I'm sorry. Sorry. Don't anybody have a heart attack? I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2095. Richard?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2095 aligns the definition of former foster child with the federal standard for the purposes of higher education grants, tuition waivers, and scholarships. It declares an emergency effective on passage. There has been an amendment proposed to the committee, the Dash 1 amendments, that targets language in the existing measure. The amendment proposes to remove a 3-year time frame required due to some concern that the Department of Human Services would be able to realize the requirements in that 3-year time frame.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, it was a really bad bill without the amendment, that's all. You know. Right.
So much better. Yes.
Peggy Cooksey and Reagan Gray.
Chair Haas, Vice Chair Knopp, and the members of the committee, my name is Peggy Cooksey, and I am with the Oregon Student Access Commission at 1500 Valley River Drive, Eugene. I'm here to testify on behalf of House Bill 2095, and I thank you for this opportunity. I'm sure you're all aware of who the Student Access Commission, what we are and what we do, so I won't give you the standard spiel that I give on what our agency does. However, I myself work with the Chaffee Education and Training Grant for foster youth attending post-secondary education. Each year, academic year, we have approximately $700,000 that goes out to these youth, to about 270 students. The House Bill 2095 concerns a tuition and fee waiver program that was passed in the prior legislative session in House Bill 3471. The purpose of 2095 is to align the eligibility definition of a foster youth or former foster youth for tuition and fee waiver with the federal definition used for the Chaffee program. In Section 1, Paragraph 5 of House Bill 2095, the changes specifically address the age and time in care. Under the original tuition and fee waiver bill, an eligible foster youth was determined to have been in foster care for 1 year after their 16th birthday. However, for the Chaffee program, which is a federally funded program, a youth must have been in substitute care for 6 months or 180 days after their 14th birthday and not have been released from care until their 16th birthday. So there is a disparity between the two. Also, the original House Bill 3471 in the prior legislature did not address tribal youth who are in care in the tribal agencies. The House Bill 2095 includes language change that includes the tribal youth. The positive results of aligning the age groups would be that it would certainly provide equity for all foster youth who would be eligible for the same program. It eliminates a subset of Chaffee youth who would not be eligible for tuition and fee waiver. Right now, we're looking at probably about 40 students a year at what we saw this past year. And it certainly would be easier to administer and identify the youth who are eligible for both programs for the Department of Human Services, OSAC, and the colleges and universities that they are attending. Thank you.
Okay, Reagan.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Reagan Gray. I'm representing Children First for Oregon, and I submitted written testimony on behalf of Pamela Butler, who is the Child Welfare Policy Manager with Children First, and Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We are testifying in support of House Bill 2095.
Children First and really the youth group, Oregon Foster Youth Connections, pushed the tuition waiver bill in the last legislative session, successfully got it passed. And so Children First tends to be a place where a lot of the questions come regarding the tuition waiver bill. We've received a number of calls about the difficulty with the alignment of the federal and state definitions. So we are very supportive of that change. The other thing that has come up is has to do with a requirement for DHS to certify that these children haven't been out of school for more than 3 years, and unfortunately, DHS in their ORCIDS program does not necessarily collect that data. There were 500 children or youth in the last year that they were unable to determine whether they had been in school within the last 3 years, and so unable to determine whether they were eligible for the waiver. And so we have brought forward the Dash 1 amendment, which would just delete that that requirement of that they have to have been out of school no more than 3 years. We still have within there the parameter that they have to finish school within by the age 25. And the reason why we kind of have this a little bit later age is a lot of youth stay in care until age 21. So 21 to 25, there's your 4 years. So we feel that that bracket is still, you know, holds together the legislation. And a little bit of background on this, the reason why we had a weird definition of former foster youth and a strange definition regarding the 3 years out of school, when we wrote the legislation, we tagged on to an existing scholarship fund for former foster youth that was in state statute that was operational in 2001 and then wasn't after that. And so we just tagged onto that legislation. Now that we're actually going into implementation, we're seeing where there are problems. So we support the original bill, but we would support it even more with the Dash 1 amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. I it's somewhat irrelevant to this technical fix here, but do we have any data on, it's been about 10 years since we started doing this, on success or failure or
Chair Haas, members of the committee, this is the first year we've done the tuition waiver. It's only been implemented for 1 year. What I was referring to was there was a scholarship fund that was funded by the legislature once in 2001, and when it ran out of money, it was never refunded again.
How's that? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So not very good on that one.
Well, 2 years.
Those 2 years might have done
well. Yeah, there may be some kids. Yeah.
I think it was referred to in the previous bill that were this an up year, things like that could be funded. Questions? Thank you both.
Thank you.
We need some more financial documentation for the amendment. We have to wait for that. So.
Thank you.
So we will carry over 2193. We'll close public hearing on House Bill 2095. We'll carry over House Bill 2193. And I think that clears our agenda for the day. I do appreciate you sort of weighing in, because I think you might need this for your caucuses down the road, that the higher education scenario where the Senate is doing the University Boards Bill and sending it to Ways and Means, the House is doing the Governance Bill, send it down, and they will both come to our floors. And those are pretty technical.
Yes, they are.
20 issues, so.
You got these set up for your kids, you know?
Yeah, 3 out of 4.
With nothing else before us, we are adjourned.